to me, what we learn, the revelatory aspects, come from the non-celebrities, so-called. You make a celebrity, you know, I think it was something value-free. Einstein is celebrated. So is Yasha Gabor. They get equal time. Perhaps he gets more than he does. That's what I'm talking about. And that's what you're talking about, too.
But there are book celebrities. I remember Nancy Davis. Nancy Davis, the president's daughter. Is that her name?
Yeah, Nancy. Yeah. No, she's
what
Nancy?
Was it? Patty Davis.
Patty. Well, she's interesting.
Yeah, she may be in. Did you interview her?
No.
Well, she wrote a book some time ago. It was a novel, and I was kind of interested in it. And then I saw that what they had done when she came to publicize the book, they got a room, a ballroom, in a hotel, and held a news conference. And I figured, well, if I can't do if I can't sit across from an author and talk to him or her,
well,
I wasn't going to go to that.
Feel like, oh, of course. See, once you do that, then you become, then it's something processed, and that's it. They all get the same thing. It doesn't matter. And even the questions, the answers are all... The word is processed. Processed foods, and there's processed thinking, and there's processed news. You know, TV bites, the phrase, the TV bite, 11, 12 seconds. They're taught that. So how can people be enlightened and vote for the right guys or even think about it? That's what we're talking about.
You have a Daily Show in Chicago, don't you?
Yeah, it's one after 35 years now. My Hour, I did a book called Working. And one of the things of it is discontent because people don't have say over what they do. No decision-making power, like the spot welder. Has no idea what the car is going to be like when he works at that Ford plant. It could be a Pinto. But my Hour is mine. I'm the old-time cabinet maker, beginning to end. And so one day I might be reading a short story by Flannery O'Connor or Ring Lardner. Next it might be paying tribute to Duke Ellington, playing Ellington recordings or... interviewing the writer of a book. Let's say Neil Sheehan's new book, Bright Book, which is a powerful one. The one about Van, the death of this guy in Vietnam. And it's the death of not of just one guy, it's the death of the American century. Could be that, or it could be a community people talking, anything. And so, maybe one day just disc jockey stuff, generally.
What a wonderful...
And so it's my Hour.
Yeah.
That's the point is, I make the decision of what that hour is going to be, so it's great. I'm fortunate.
They have any openings at that station?
It's a remarkable station, by the way, this WFMT. Died out a little, it's now the, it's called Fine Art Station. It does classical music primarily. I'm what I call it's one aberration. But they do live stuff from, you know, the Lyric, of course, and the Chicago Symphony, but also San Francisco. They carry Glyndebourne, all that festivals and... a lot of opera openings and symphonic stuff, and they play live chamber music there. It's quite a remarkable station, 24 hours a day.
And you've been on 30 years?
35.
35 years?
Yeah. I was bounced around at the beginning, you know, I just bounced around, and then suddenly I hear. Well, you know how it began? There was how part of this began. I was a disc jockey before the word disc jockey was used. Dave Garraway and I, you heard Dave Garraway?
Oh, sure.
You know, he was the first host of the Today Show that revolutionized American morning habits. It did. There wasn't no such thing as television before 6 o'clock or no, after 10. And Chicago was one of the places. Remember, it was a new medium. It was not the sales medium it is today. So with the new medium, it's in the hands of the creative people, you know, not in the hands of the formula people. So there were three shows out of Chicago. Garraway at Large, which was easygoing guy. Kukla, Fran, and Ollie.
Mm-hmm.
With the one genius of Chicago, I think, Bert Hillstrom, in my show called Stud's Place. All three had something in common. There was an air of improvisation about them, like an art program, a little restaurant. At the end, it would say, dialogue by the cast. So we had a script, that is a page. Read the plot, and then we do it, and by the time it's airtime, we do it, and it comes off on time. People thought there was a Stud's Place, a place they could go to, something good in one way or another would happen. But there wasn't.
They kept calling you for reservations.
Oh, you think I'm kidding? All women on the street and say, where is Stud's Place? And I says, it's here. You know? And 20 years after it was knocked off the air, and 20 years after it was knocked off, now and then getting off a bus and through the windows, you two women looking at me and they're going, meaning what happened to it, which died 20 years ago. So that was the... Then Oh, then I got in trouble. You know, it was McCarthy time. Well, nothing. I have a big mouth.
Were you wearing a red sweater?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's always the color of my politics. And so I signed many petitions, you know, and I spoke in many places. I did, because I believe, you know, we should end Jim Crow, as it was called then. This is before the 60s, you know. Yeah, it should be price control. And some of the people there on that list were considered subversives. I said, I don't care what they're considered. Do I believe in this thing? And I do. All I had to say is, by that time I was known as a valuable property. That's the word they use, you know, Studs Place. Dave went to New York for today, and Mike Wallace went, he was in Chicago, went there, and Cooper, and I was considered hot stuff, too. And all you could do was stand up and say you were duped. I said, but I wasn't duped, you know. I believe that, you know. And people say, Studs, you were so courageous. That's a lot of, well, I wasn't courageous. It was my ego, you see. Ego was the important thing.
What did they want of you?
I did it, huh?
What did they want of you?
They want me to say I was duped by communists, you know. I was duped.
The management of the station.
Yeah, of course. Well, an NBC VP came in. Stud Place was a very hot show. You know, it was 1951, 50 to 52, around there, about that. And then was knocked off because I was stupidly stubborn. I wouldn't say I was duped. Because I say my ego was important. I think I'm fairly bright and so on. Say I'm duped means I'm kind of stupid. And people said you were courageous. I wasn't there at all. In any event, and then I'm listening one day to a radio station, FM, and they're playing a Woody Guthrie record, Dust Bowl Ballad. Well, no one played Woody except me. When I go to this job, I said, who's playing Woody Guthrie on the radio? And they said, we are. I said, I want to work for you. And he said, sure, we know you. You're great, but we have no money. I said, well, neither have I, so we're even. And that's how I started 35 years ago on that station.
Without pay?
Well, we got something. They paid a little buck or two here. But then bit by bit, the station itself was catching on. Audience liked the music coming out of it. It's the only station in the country that doesn't have canned commercials. It's all live. No jingles, nothing, no station in the country. It's all live, everything. The announcer says it, we do it. And since then, I've been on that station all that time. And I enjoy it. And all sorts of people I run into, one way or another.
I want to work up to the great divide. I want to go back a little further. Are you a native Chicagoan?
I was born in New York City, but I was 8 years old. I was born 1912. So it was 1920. Came to Chicago, day coach. My folks, by that time, my mother had a little rooming house in Chicago. And that's how it started. Then we moved to a little hotel that we had. And that hotel became more or less my, how you say, my university. Sure, I went to the University of Chicago Law School like a fool. I didn't like it. But my training, I think, was in the lobby of that little hotel.
Called Studs Place.
Well, it's called the Wells Grand Hotel. In fact, in one of the books, the memoir I did, sort of a memoir called Talking to Myself, I talked my memoir. You know, then I wrote it, of course. But I talked to give it the impulse of you hearing somebody on the voice from the page of the book. And in it, Memoir of My Times, and that's what I call it. And so in it, the Wells Grand Hotel figures a great deal.
Well, you didn't like law school. What did you do when you left the University of Chicago?
Well, that's just it. I was very unhappy at law school. Passed the bar after flunking the first. Depression was going on. We didn't lose the hotel, but a lot of vacancies were there. And then there were government agencies coming into being under Roosevelt, the New Deal. So something called the WPA, which is Work Project Administration, was something called FERA, Federal Emergency Relief Administration. And it's a statistical project, finding out about unemployment in certain industries in the country. And I got a job doing that. And so one thing led to another. And then my dream was to be a playgoer, not to be a player, a playgoer. See plays and read papers and see a ball game and see good movies and have a civil service job, 9 to 5, which I had for a short time in Washington. And but I also joined this theater group. I didn't mean to, but this guy got me to join. And I'm in a play. Next thing I know, I'm in a play. And Chicago is the home of soap operas, radio soap operas. So I became one of the very frequently heard gangsters, and Ma Perkins and Mary Marlin, and I was always threatening the good people of the community.
Oh, that's how you got into broadcasting.
Yeah, I was a gangster, Chicago gangster. I'm the guy who said, get in there, you guys, that was me.
And that...
And one thing led to another, and then disc jockeying came into being after that.
What station?
Well, WENR. Paul Harvey and I broke in together. I broke in before he did, but a man brings an acetate record, and it's this kid with the voice, it's Harvey, and I said, oh my God, this is incredible. He's too late. He says the audience's letters are pouring, and they love him. And the funny thing is, in fairness to him, he didn't know it, we were sponsored by a syndicate beer company. Great middle American Paul Harvey was sponsored by a mob beer outfit, but he did. In fairness to him, he didn't know it. It's called Eight Oys.
So your radio work inevitably led to Studs Place, television.
And then TV was coming into being. A man named Charlie Andrews, who was producer of Dave Garraway's show, liked my show, the disc jockey show called The Wax Museum. It was called that because records were wax space, pre-LP, and I play old-time records, the Wax Museum. He liked it. He said, how about doing a TV show? You talk and the bartender. One thing led to another, became a little restaurant. And so that was it. And then came FMT, and then came these books, pretty much by accident. One thing, how I came to write these books, I would say an accretion of accidents. And that's what it was.
They were really interesting ideas, these oral histories, working and the Great War, or the Good War, I'm sorry. The interesting thing about them is that you talk such a cross-section of people, and they all sound so articulate, but you must do a lot of cleaning up.
Well, it's their words, you know. The words are the words of the people themselves. What I do is you synthesize, you cut. I call myself a gold prospector. You know, I hear about a certain person back in 1849. They in Kentucky, wherever they were, Tennessee, heard about the gold strike in California. And they head out, I head for that person. Then they start digging, they find their spot where the gold may be, the prospect. He's digging and digging, out comes all this ore. And here comes the interview, and out comes all these transcribed pages, 60 pages. Now you've got to find the gold dust. So whatever the prospector does, he filters and sifts, and out comes a handful of gold dust. Out come these 6-7 pages of editing, cutting. But at the same time, it's the words of that person. It's the truth of that person. That's the delicate part. But it's sort of a highlighting of the truth. And so all people have a sort of a, I shouldn't say all, but there's an articulateness, more or less, in everybody.
And everybody has a story.
May, but not all. I mean, in fairness, I wouldn't say we all may be created equal, but we're not equal. That is, some are more articulate than others one way or another. Some have more insights. The person I look for, let's say a housewife, someone says, you know, you ought to see Gladys down there, or Florence. She's the one you should see. She's different. Well, what's different about her? Well, she's not a flake. I don't mean she's a flake, but she's a little different. And when she says something, you got a feeling that's right. And so that person I see is the one who's able to articulate what the others may feel inchoately, can't express. She may have some kind of insight they don't have. And that's the person. So it's the ordinary person who at times says extraordinary things. That's basically the people in the book.
So one person often leads to another person.
Oh, very often. I read about somebody in a book. I read them, now and then in a magazine or here, or some person tells me something. You know, for example, I was leaving this Appalachian couple, many Appalachians in Chicago. And it's a rainy night, and I'm in the cab, and the cab driver sees this tape recorder, the big one, he says, you a journalist? I said, well, sort of. He says, I got a story to tell. He said, did you see Lord Jim? Movie? I says, the Joseph Conrad thing. I didn't see it. He says, well, you know, it's about a coward who finds courage. That's me. And that's why I joined the John Birch Society. And so I said, I got to see this guy. And out of it comes a very fascinating tale. Over and beyond, not just the cliche you have is, you know, this political Neanderthal. It's not that. It's this guy fearful of the world and why he want to belong to something that'll make him less, more than he feels he is, and a seeking of esteem, perverse though it might be. Well, that's a story, you see. All this, in the middle of this guy, he believes in war and all that, but at the same time, He was a guard in a jail. And he says, I never forgot. One day I said to one of the inmates, so what time is it? Why, you in a hurry to catch a plane or something? I felt so bad, I apologized. I followed him around. Because here's this human being in jail, and I just hurt his feelings. Same guy. And they bawled me out fraternizing with prisoners. So you see, there's so many dimensions to people. I like those dimensions of what haunt me.
Well, what happens when, say, Gladys down the street, as you mentioned a moment ago, you knock on her door? I mean, how do you explain yourself? Studs Terkel standing there with a tape recorder.
Well, by that time, she doesn't know me. I mean, I'm known in some quarters, not known. If I am, I break that down easily enough because I goof up. Yeah, I'm not very good mechanically. And sometimes I need that person to help me. I can't drive a car. Never sat behind a wheel in my life. And they call me the poet of the tape recorder. I don't know how it works, you know. And so I press the wrong button sometimes. Not deliberately. In the past, I did that. And that person helps me. And that's important. That person feels needed by me. That's a great need in every human being, to feel needed by someone. So that's all part of it. And I'm the partner that I call myself a fellow passenger with them. That I'm as vulnerable as that person is. And they sense something like that. But also it's a conversation. Might have coffee, might have a meal, and we're talking. And that's pretty much how it works.
When you were interviewing people for The Great Divide, how did you explain to them what you were trying to do?
Well, I was just saying that we live at a certain time today, and it depends who it is. It might be Doug Roth, a defrocked Lutheran pastor in Pittsburgh. I heard about him. I said, well, I want to hear your story. Why are you defrocked? Why are you doing what you're doing? Challenging this big bank and getting in trouble and getting canned, you know. Or Jean Gump, this Catholic grandmother. Why is she going to the missile site? Or this teacher teaching at Bowling Green, which is very often used by pollsters. That's a typical American college. His experience with the kids who have no sense of past interest. Some other teacher does. So they're very free and easy. I call them up and tell them what I'm working on. Can they spare an hour or two to just chew the fat about what they do? But what they see, what they feel, that's pretty much it. That's what the other books, too, different themes. Some books deal with memory. There's hard times due to the Great Depression of the 30s, the Good War, World War II, memories. This book deals with a loss of memory to some extent, an absence of memory, a now without the then. That's one of the difficulties we're facing today. So that becomes a theme. In all these books, I guess I'm trying to paint a portrait of a country then, at certain moments in history, and now, at a certain, I would say, traumatic moment.
As I was reading The Great Divide and going through all of these interviews, these statements, I was looking for a common thread, but I couldn't find any because everybody's story was so different. Is that an accurate perception?
Well, no, that's an interesting point you're making. See, this is a more difficult book than the others, because they dealt with past. And there was a common thread, and that was through memory. An event, World War II, or an event, the Depression, or a day's work on the job working, or the first book, The Victory to America, The City Before and Then, Prophets Came. Now you're dealing with a now. So I split it in things where the divide occurs. In religion, for example, we know there's a growth in fundamentalism at the expense of mainline churches. But even fundamentalism, there's a divide. The same two people can interpret the Bible literally and yet come to different points of view, as in families. The son, he and his father are both evangelical Christians, and their fundamentalists interpret the Bible literally. But he went to El Salvador as a missionary, and he came back. And the family Bible is on that table, same Bible. The old man loves what this administration is doing in Central America. I think Reagan is right, and the administration is right in what they're doing. In the Bible, he quotes the Bible. The son also quotes the Bible. At least I quote it from the standpoint of the campesinos, the peasants of that country. They quote it literally, too, about the oppressed and oppressors. So even in fundamentalism, just as there is Falwell and Swaggart, there are also peace movements among the fundamentalists. You know, that aspect is going on. So that's one split of the young generational split, too, in memory. Labor and anti-union, the splits that are going on. There's a family And she's on strike against TWA, the flight attendant. Her husband is a pilot, crosses the picket line. So even in families, see, so it's in miniature and it's in broad form, the split of past and present of within. You have the police chief of Minneapolis, a very interesting guy, Tony Boza, arrested his wife 5 times. He believes in law and order. He also is sympathetic to her, but she's a peace demonstrator. She violated the law, arrests her. And they're a great couple. So that's also part of it, you see. So there are these common denominators. It's a split. And even within individuals, and here's the, perhaps this could be the metaphor that may summarize everything, the case. There's a guy teaching in Little Rock. It's an extension, University of Arkansas. His name is Bob Franke. He's in the book. The kids are almost all fundamentalists, you know, and all ultra conservative. The subject of AIDS came up. The theme was plagues of the past, a course in science, plagues and superstitions, and AIDS comes up. And every one of the kids says they send to these people, have it coming, no mercy for them, no compassion. Then he shows a little documentary film in the same classroom, and they all start weeping. And they're weeping for the very ones they cursed. So there's a split right there. Jean Gump, this Catholic grandmother who was in jail at the time awaiting sentence because she went to a missile site and tried to cause a little trouble because she believed that Jesus meant what he said. You know, and under God, one nation under God can take just so much of this, you understand. After all, he meant what he said. You if we're under, you know, the very one to say one nation under God, by the way, don't like that, taking Jesus too seriously. But she did. So she's in jail awaiting sentence, and this matron, the guard, slipping the ashtray, the lunch tray under the slot, says, God bless you, Mrs. Gump, for what you're doing. Then Jean Gump says, I see you're drawing the line, the other matron, and she walks rigidly out. Same person, you see. This defrocked Lutheran pastor, he's walking me to the airport in Pittsburgh after I spent time with him and his colleagues. And he's recognized everybody. He's been in the papers. He's been mocked and scorned by the press and everybody. And the people looking at him, they recognize him. He looks like a big linebacker. And now and then somebody comes up and whispers to him. And what they say, he says, keep it up, pastor. I'm with you. Walked away. You see? So you have this double theme going on. That's what I'm hitting, really.
Well, there are certainly divisions among us, and this is made clear in The Great Divide, and yet, can we draw a conclusion that in spite of these divisions, there is still a great deal of unanimity among the American people?
I think the unanimity is the wanting. There's a wanting of something better than what is at this moment. I think there's a wanting of a certain kind of peace and a security. There's a wanting of economic security as well. We know that the farmer, for example, today is the small farmer in many cases the same spot as the farmer was in the Grapes of Wrath days. You know. And labor, we know the big plants, the heavy industry's taken a beating as plants are closed. The economy's shifting something more service. We speak of the employment, unemployment going down. But we forget that a good deal is going down if the steel worker getting $15 an hour is now working $3.50, $4 an hour pumping gas. You see, all this is part of this moment. The best way to summarize it all, you know, before we take off, I think, would be a phrase used during World War II, just before the Normandy invasion in June 1944. The phrase was situation fluid. Situation fluid. Imagine this political campaign, 34% haven't made up their mind. There's nothing like that ever. One out of three voters, perhaps even more, 2 out of 5, haven't made up their mind. Situation fluid. And that's, I think, how it stands at the moment. And that's what I try to capture in the book. It's sort of a challenge, the book is.
There is a degree of pessimism that runs all through The Great Divide. But your own conclusions, are you pessimistic?
It's both. Pessimism at the same time, the more grassroots groups than ever before in the history of the country. You know, I mean grassroots groups that don't make the headlines. You know, in the 60s it was the civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam War protests. They may be the same Florence, this housewife Gladys we're talking about, who may be leading a campaign against toxic waste dumps in the community and stopping the big outfit. Maybe a whole group stop on the utility from an outrageous hike. That's going on. But there's been no coalescence of them. So it's both. You ask if I'm pessimistic or optimistic. I call myself an emotional yo-yo. I wake up, there's a headline, we're not going to make it. We're not going to make it. Then you bump into Florence and Gladys and all her colleagues. Hey, these people are fantastic. Now they're going to be a coalescence. We'll make it. That's even better, more than ever before. So it's both. Situation fluid.
I was shocked when I saw in your postscript about Mrs. Gump that she received 8 years in prison.
Yeah, the judge was very kind. It was Christmas time, so he made it six. Someone said she serves 1 year more than Chambers does. Would you believe that?
Shocking.
I just sent her the book yesterday, a hardback. You understand, they're not allowed to get hardbacks in prison unless it comes from the publisher. So I had to wait to get here to have Pantheon send the book to her and to her husband. Her husband followed suit, and he's in his Minnesota pokey. And they always say, Gene and Joe Gump are a great love story. But can you imagine the network, whatever network that does Dynasty or Dallas, doing the Gene and Joe Gump story? Which is a great love story.
Your book, The Good War, which you taped, I remember going around the house about 2 days listening to it in your presentation.
Oh, yeah,
so
you heard that.
Great.
I did tape that.
Yeah, that was so good.
Thank you.
That's a wonderful thing. Well, it's great talking to you. I imagine that, just to kind of wrap things up, just to ask this last question, I guess in Chicago, you know everybody and everybody knows you.
Well, for better or for worse, sort of known around town.
You can't go down through the loop without being stopped about 20
yeah,
times.
Yeah, every now and then they say, how you doing, you know. It's an easy going. It's almost a small town kind of thing.
And you make it look very romantic.
Oh, that's it, those pictures. Those photographs are fantastic. That's the Chicago. The great book on Chicago, mine is a takeoff again, the great book by Nelson Algren. Called Chicago City on the Make. That's a great poetic prose portrait of the city. Mine is a follow-up on it, really.
Studs Terkel, wonderful to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
A great divide, Studs Terkel.